I'm pleased to be here, have a chance to talk to you for a few minutes on what I consider a major crisis facing our community. We don't have the PowerPoint. I'll make sure that it's available to those of you who would like to see some of the information I'm providing. But really, to put this in the context of how important it is for Nathiel to think about this issue as it relates to the future of our community. It's very important that presidents and chancellors are here because you are the vanguard. And if we don't address these issues at HBCUs, they won't be addressed anywhere else in a meaningful way. We have to take the first step. I'm also pleased that this is the topic for this conference. There's many things you can talk about. You can talk about all the successes, but this is the biggest challenge that we face in the 21st century. And to define it, I would say it's the challenge of the disappearing African-American male. I mean, literally disappearing before our very eyes. And disappearing in a way that has impact on every aspect of our lives, not just education, but in terms of employment, in terms of family, in terms of faith. We are seeing the impact dramatically in so many different areas, and we have to find a way to address it in a meaningful way. I want to take a step back before I take a step forward, because it's amazing that we've thought about these problems before. They're not new problems. Indeed, if we talk about a call to arms, I went back and found a speech written in 1935 by W.E.B. Du Bois. And Du Bois, as all of you know who studied him, he is a brother who never minced words. He tried to be clear in identifying the nature of the problem and what we had to do about it. And long before we thought about integration, long before we thought about the idea of affirmative action, long before we talked about access, he was talking about the challenges of the 20th century, not just the challenge of the 20th century was the color line, but he also talked about education in a way that we need to understand it, and he really was speaking to this audience about the challenge. He said in 1935, in the Journal of Negro Education, July 1935, does the Negro need separate schools? That was his question. It was a very provocative question 70 years ago. And here we are, 70 years later, what did he tell us then? He said the Negro needs neither separate nor mixed schools. What he needs is education. What you must remember is that there is no magic either in mixed schools or segregated schools. A mixed school with poor, unsympathetic teachers, with hostile public opinion, and no teaching of the truth concerning black folk is bad. A segregated school with ignorant placeholders, inadequate equipment, poor salaries is equally bad. Other things being equal, the mixed school is the broader, more natural basis for the education of all youth. It gives wider contacts, it inspires great self-confidence, and suppresses the inferiority complex. But other things seldom are equal. And in that case, sympathy, knowledge, and the truth outweigh all that the mixed schools can offer. He told us about the problem that we've noticed in the 20th century. And then, indeed, the way that we can solve this problem is not, we don't have to go very far. We just celebrated on May 17, 2004, the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. And we celebrated, I think, the wrong way. We applauded the great Supreme Court for a decision on issues 50 years ago. We applauded Earl Warren for having the ability to convince nine other justices to write an opinion that was unanimous and unambiguous about what we had to do to make sure we had an integrated educational system. We applauded the country going forward as a matter of principle and resolve in a moral consciousness to talk about education as a reality for our communities. But as we look closer, it's a much more complicated picture than that opinion might really suggest. For example, on May 17, 1954, the court did change its mind and get rid of separate but equal. But you know what? It was almost accidental. That is, the very Supreme Court that heard the arguments of Thurgood Marshall and Oliver Beale and Constance Baker Motley and so many others, James Mayer, Mayer, and others, the Supreme Court in the 1950s, after the case had been Brown, five of those Supreme Court justices, five, the majority, were not prepared in 1952 or 1953 to reverse Plessy v. Ferguson. They were still sticking to the separate but equal doctrine. They were not going to change it. And indeed, the Chief Justice of the Court in the state of Virginia, state of Kentucky, Fred Vinson was among those five. And something happened on September 8, 1953 that changed the nation. Chief Justice Fred Vinson died unexpectedly. And to tell you that the Supreme Court weren't nine men, all they were white men, they weren't given a man that well, one of them, Philip Sanford from Harvard Law School, was on the court. You think there would be a level of sympathy losing one of his colleagues and the Chief Justice. When you went out to lunch with his law clerk and learned that the Chief Justice had died on September 8th, and he was a religious man, he said, quote, "This is the first indication I've ever had that the human is a God." So it tells you that the Supreme Court is not dead and done on this issue. They are deeply divided. Earl Warren came and got a unanimous court, but you also need to understand Earl Warren in another context. As we celebrated Brown, more than 150,000 American citizens who happen to be of Japanese descent were not celebrating Earl Warren. Earl Warren was the governor of California. He was the attorney general, but he also was responsible for the pivotal role in placing 170,000 Japanese Americans in internment camps in the Second World War. They were not terrorists. They didn't assault anybody. They didn't kill anybody. It was just a knee-jerk reaction. So there was a mixed reaction even when you think about Earl Warren and what he did. We celebrate Brown because it was an important decision, and it's important because it gives a context to race. And I want to just give you a context of what it meant. In 1954, on May 17th, the court issued an opinion, and think about what they said 50 years ago, because it tells us how important education is to our very survival. In that opinion, the Supreme Court said as follows. Today, 1954, education is perhaps the most important function of state and local governments. It is required in the performance of our most basic public responsibilities, even service in the armed forces. It is the very foundation of good citizenship. Today, it is the principal instrument in awakening the child to cultural values and preparing them for later professional training and in helping them to adjust normally to this environment. In these days, it is doubtful that any child may reasonably be expected to succeed in life if he is denied the opportunity of an education. Such an opportunity, where the state has undertaken to provide it, is a right which must be made available to all on equal terms. So we come then to the question presented in Brown. Does segregation of children in public facilities and other tangible factors, where other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of a minority group of equal educational opportunities? We conclude that it does. That's what they said in Brown. Separate education and equal education was the result of the preceding Brown. And it was a major and important victory. But what you don't realize is that the victory was a result of this very audience. We are old enough to remember 50 years ago, the reason we won that case, it wasn't the Supreme Court, it wasn't the benevolence of a few judges, it was because the lawyers who raised the issues of God, who worked for 20 years to cultivate the arguments, were all graduates, especially as the all graduates of HBCUs and Howard Law School just across town. It's important because history has allowed us to forgive that. People have been talking about prison based services for decades. No white lawyer, no other lawyer was able to even pierce the veil of racism at the highest level. They could not win. And those lawyers, Irving Marshall and Oliver Neal and Spencer Robinson, were all Howard Law School graduates. And they were trained by a Washington, D.C. lawyer, a Harvard Law School graduate, the first African American on the Harvard Law Review, a person who got the first advanced degree of Harvard Law Review, a person whose name was not on any of the briefs in the Brown case, but the person responsible for changing the Supreme Court's mind, even though he was dead in 1954, and the person we have to salute as the real leader out of darkness, is the great Charles Hamilton Kingsley. I say that because what I'm doing now, and I wish I had a PowerPoint to show you, is that my life's work now, everything I do moving forward at Harvard Law School, working at Howard, working at institutions, is dedicated to Charles Huntington Houston. My new job is the director of a brand new institute called the Charles Huntington Institute for Race and Justice. All of what I do will be focused on that. And it's important that we think about this, not just lawyers, not just educators, not just presidents and chancellors, universities. Think of what Houston said in the 1930s to his students, and it's just as applicable to us today. He said to the law students there who is trained first that in order to be successful as a lawyer, you have to be twice as good as white lawyers. That's the nature of what he's going to confront in a racist political and legal system. That was on the court, but he also says, let me just show you something. Education does not necessarily mean that you're going to be able to make a difference. Because he said, there are two types of lawyers, and you are one or the other. He said, a lawyer is either a social engineer or a parasite. That means you're using every bit of your legal training to lift your community up, to make it better, to make it stronger, to make it more vibrant, or you are a disease in that very community. You are selfish and focused on your own interests. That's what you just told us 70 years ago about what lawyers should do. It means lawyers, educators, principals, superintendents, everyone has to decide, are you a social engineer? Or are you a parasite? Are you helping or harming the community? We have to ask ourselves that every single day we try to do our work. And we train some great ones. Stephen Marshall, one of his great students at Harvard Law School. Oliver Neal, one of his great students. And I urge you to do this every time I have the occasion. I urge people to do this. Ira Hill will be 98 years old on May 1st. He lives in Richmond, Virginia. Write him a letter and say thank you. Because what he has done is so significant in terms of being a living legacy, and we almost don't know that he exists. A remarkable person has had a remarkable impact on our community, and we need to make sure that we can appreciate this great leader. And so I urge you to write him, and Richmond will provide an address for you as well. The second thing is that these lawyers were so great because they had one goal, not to get a lot of money, not to be prestigious, but simply to work on cases that were focused on social engineering, changing the status of our community. That's what they did. And what's important about that, that we also have to remember that there were two Brown decisions. They won that first one, 1954, but the Supreme Court a year later issued Brown 2 on May 31st, 1955. We celebrate that event this coming May. Now, why is that important? We celebrate Brown 1, but Brown 2 is even more important, particularly for those who understand what happened after Brown 1. On May 31st, 1955, the Supreme Court issued a second Brown decision saying, quote, these cases, all the Brown cases, are remanded to the district courts to take such proceedings and enter such orders and decrees consistent with this opinion as are necessary and proper to admit to public schools on a racially non-discriminatory basis with all the limited speed the parties to these cases. And David Marshall, Oliver Neal, Carson Baker Marley, James Newman, all these lawyers were celebrating this fantastic second unanimous victory in Brown. But as these brothers were celebrating, as it always is the case, a sister went to the library and put out a dictionary and looked up the word deliberate and determined that the word deliberate meant smell. And indeed, the Supreme Court had said, and segregation said, do so with all deliberate speed, which told the nation with no speed at all. And that is precisely what happened in 1955. We learned the Brown case twice, and nothing changed. Indeed, something changed, but not what we expected. And our Congress, right up the year, members of Congress throughout the South signed something called the Seven Manifesto, a written agreement that met with the members of all the people of Mississippi and Alabama and North Carolina and West Virginia and Virginia. They signed an agreement saying that we will resist integration by any means necessary. These people elected to represent us, and they had an agreement not to enforce the Brown decision. Right across the board in the state of Virginia, in the state of Virginia, racism is so pervasive that if Virginia didn't shut down a district school or a county school, the entire public education system was shut down in Virginia so that white children would not go to the same schools as black children. White children had options, private schools, religious schools. Our children were not educated for years because of resistance to Brown. It wasn't just Virginia. If you go to the state of Alabama, George Wallace became a political success by saying segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Mr. Wallace was the same thing in Mississippi. Governor Orvin Sanders was state of Arkansas, stood at Central High School and refused to let black students come into that high school. That's what Brown committed massive resistance to us going to public schools. But clear something else, two other important things. One was massive white flight from these urban areas. And I want to be clear that we're on the same page about Brown. The man misunderstands that there's more you start for what they ask for. We have never said, we do not argue, we do not believe, and they did not argue in 1950 or beyond, that in order for a black child to learn, they have to be sitting in the classroom next to a white child. That's not what they said. Remember, what they said was, we want to go where the resources are. And if the resources are in those institutions, we need to be there because the second but equal is not giving us equal resources, but we can learn if you give us the opportunity and access to the resources, we can learn. And that's what we want to do. And we should never let our children think that they can only learn when they're sitting next to somebody, or that they can learn if they give them the right education and the right opportunities. That's what Brown is about. 50 years ago, that was great news. We have finally opened the door. And it's because of people like me, Harvard Law School, Stanford Law School, Stanford University, those are all important accomplishments to be a senior professor at Harvard Law School, the seventh black in the history of this 1900-year institution. But I wasn't the seventh qualified. I wasn't the first to be qualified. There were many talented people that should have been on that faculty decades ago, centuries ago, but it was racism that stopped it. And so all of us have to remember, wherever we are standing on very broad shoulders of somebody else who made the sacrifice. And they make a move with us, and we have to understand that. But we have a crisis now. That's why I'm talking about a call to arms. Here we are 50 years after that. 50 years after this great opportunity for access, and we find ourselves in the year 2005 with more segregation in our communities than we had 50 years ago. We find ourselves with greater dropout rates among African American males than we've ever had before. We find ourselves in the year 2005 with a criminal justice system with 2 million people in jail. 1 million of them are African American, almost all of them are males. That's what we find in the year 2005. It's a challenge that we have to address in a real and serious way. And we have to do it with a sense of sustained responsibility. They always challenge HBCU's role in education. But we've always persevered, no matter how long we look around, when you talk about black doctors, black lawyers, black entrepreneurs, black educators, black nurses, they all start in HBCUs. We'll continue to produce our best and brightest if we continue to keep our eyes on the prize. We can't do it without you. We can't do it without you. And we also have to do it in a way that we understand the challenges that we face. We have to look at what I call Little B, No Child Left Behind. My friends call it No Child Left Standing. We'll get to that. But the challenge here is that there are some good ideas and concepts like No Child Left Behind. It makes sense that a child who's in a failing school to have the opportunity to go to a non-failing school. That's the deal with that. The reality is that we have so many failing schools. Tens of thousands, now hundreds of thousands of children in failing schools, and only hundreds of positions for them to go. So we can't be tricked by this idea of vouchers. We can't be tricked by the nature I left behind when there's still a need I left behind. And we can't stop the mission of HBCUs in particular of being in the vanguard to educate the most, the best, and the brightest of our children. You have to do it. The goal you made earlier gave me a glimpse of what we are dealing with. And my new project is called the O'Connell Project. And what does that mean? This is a project that's actually in response to Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's opinion 2 years ago in the Michigan case. Now, when you made that opinion, we first celebrated because she said something that was very important and quite powerful. Her first remarks in that case were, Justice Powell emphasized that nothing less than the nation's future depends upon leaders trained through wide exposure to the ideas and morals of students as diverse as this nation of many peoples. But that is, we have to have opportunities for everyone to serve if we want to be successful as a nation. That was great. But she said something else at the conclusion of that opinion that wasn't part of the opinion, but it was what we call a dicta. It was an aspirational view. It was a perspective not relevant to the actual opinion, but it's become the center of it. She said, the court expects that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interests of people today. That's a powerful statement. At first, I was angry with you 25 years from now. But I thought about it, you think about it. The court has issued us a challenge. That is, let's solve this problem in 25 years. I said, I accept that challenge. Give me the resources, give me the authority, give me the access, give me a way of rethinking what we need to do from birth through 12th grade. Give me the sort of support that you can find in a zip code right across the line, but you can't find a zip code right in the district. The same children with the same education opportunities are given vastly different options based on their zip code. That's not a fair and equal public education system. So part of the challenge is to take up Justice O'Connor and to take on the challenge of how do we solve the problem of the 21st century, which is an increasing problem of the racial achievement gap. And what they didn't hear, and what we haven't heard, was said very powerfully by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her opinion in the Green case. She said it is well documented that conscious and unconscious race bias, even white discrimination based on race, remain alive in our land, impeding the realization of our highest ideals and values. From today's vantage point, she said, one may hope but not firmly forecast that over the next generation span, progress toward non-discrimination and generally equal opportunity will make it safe to censor affirmative action. Those are great aspirational goals, but that's not the reality of what we have today. And HBCUs must let officials know, let our public officials know, let our government know that we are not there yet. And we can't do it if we continue to have the red tape, the bureaucracy, the burdens that we have inherited to try to address the problems in some meaningful way. We have to take it up in a way that makes sense and that will help further our goals. That is best exemplified by the great works of my great mentor, Thurgood Marshall. And Thurgood Marshall was a man of the people who never changed his views about what we had to do. When he was in Washington, D.C. in the Supreme Court in 1972, his fifth year in the Supreme Court, he was down the street at North Lee Hospital, very sick. And Dave, he couldn't even speak. President Nixon sent an envoy to check on him to see how he's doing. And Marshall couldn't speak, but he took a piece of paper to send a note back to the president. He wrote 2 words in that paper. And those 2 words to President Nixon was, not yet. That is, I'm not going anywhere. You're not going to replace me. I'm going to be here as long as I can. In fact, he always did with us. He said, I'm not going to retire from the Supreme Court. Indeed, I'm going to serve a lifetime. I'm so committed to this. The only way I leave the Supreme Court is when I'm 108 years old and I'm shot by a jealous husband. Other than that, I'm going to serve a lifetime. That didn't happen, but he did leave us with the challenge that we have today, and I want to end with them. That is, he told us, he gave us our marching orders. He understood how important the struggle was going forward in the 21st century. He said in his last public address, the challenge for us, what we have to do as educators and as social engineers to carry this struggle forward. He says, I wish I could say that racism and prejudice were only distant memories, and I wish that liberty and equality were just around the bend. I wish I could say that America has come to appreciate diversity and to see and accept similarity. But as I look around, I see not a nation of unity, but of division, African and white, indigenous and immigrant, rich and poor, educated and illiterate. But there's a price to be paid for division and isolation. We cannot play hostage, she said. Democracy cannot search on this field. Liberty cannot take blame on their hate. Justice cannot take root on their rage. We must go against the forbidden man. We must dissent from the indifference. We must dissent from apathy. We must dissent from the fear, the hatred, and the mistrust. We must dissent from a government that's left is wrong without jobs, education, or hope. We must dissent from the poverty vision and the absence of moral leadership. We must dissent because America can do better, because America has no choice but to do better. Take a chance, nephew. Knock down the fences that divide. Tear apart the walls that imprison. Reach out, freedom lies just on the other side. So as educators, as young students, as those trying to make a change, let's take up Justice Marshall's challenge and say that we are the 21st century dissenters. We are part of the cause. We're part of the solution. We're going to make sure that our community gets the education from birth through the high school, through college, through professional schools, because we will not leave one child, not one child behind. All children have the ability to learn. All children have hope and expectations. We will take up the ballot from 50 years ago and say our children will not just be among those considered, but among the best and the brightest to lead this nation where it needs to go in the 21st century. I urge you to take up that challenge and this call to arms and to let David Marshall and Charles Hunter's know that we are here, the vanguard of the struggle to save our children. Thank you. Saving our